Victoria for all those in navy blue.
Hello and welcome to the Fox Football Podcast Finals Edition. Great to have your company. Big show coming up because the first week of the finals were pretty enjoyable. We've got a couple of semi-finals to look forward to as well with a lot of interest. Joining me to go through it all and plenty more on the podcast today is Simon Hill as per usual.
Good to see you, Garby. How are you?
Yeah, going very well. Really enjoyed the game last night. We'll get into that in a moment. And Robbie Cornthwaite is with us as well
Back for another pod.
Good to see you, Rob.
Thanks. Good to be here.
You're a busy man at the moment.
I'm trying. I mean, retirement's got a lot of spare time on my hands, so it might seem like I'm busy because you see me doing a few things in a space of a few days, but then the rest of the week I'm looking after the kids and doing the school run.
Game last night, podcast today, A-League hour, Bill and Boz after this, and then Champions League
on
Tuesday.
You must be
raking. You've got a bigger schedule than Scott Morrison at the moment.
Oh, well, you were on Bill and Boz last night, weren't you? Sitting in for the big man.
I had to fill in because everyone was in Adelaide.
Well, we'll have to ask him how you went.
But you must be enjoying it, mate.
No, I am. I mean, you guys have been lucky enough to be able to talk football and sport for most of your careers as well. So I'm at the infancy of mine. long, long way to go to catch you boys. But so far, so good.
I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, appreciate that.
Going very well. Adelaide was, I trust, an enjoyable night, but you had a little incident that you might want to share, Simon, which maybe wasn't as enjoyable.
Well, it was funny, actually. So we arrived at our hotel in Adelaide that we always stay at. I won't name it, but we then got the hire car from the airport, of course, and we leave it there and say, can I pick the car up at 5 o'clock so I can drive to the stadium? Yep. So there were a couple of the hire cars because Adam Peacock had one and I had the other. And as I went down to pick up the keys, they said, yep, there you go, Mr. Hill. See you later. Off I got and sat in the car with Andy Harper. And I thought, oh, this car's not the one I drove in on. And there was a coat on the seat. And I said to Andy, is that Boz's coat? Adam must have taken our car and, you know, I've got his. So whatever. Slung the coat in the back. Off we drove happily to Hindmarsh Stadium. And half an hour before kickoff, I got a phone call from the hotel saying, Mr. Hill, I gave you the wrong keys. Actually, that car belongs to one of our hotel employees. Is there any chance I can come and pick the car up? And I said, well, it's going to be a bit tricky because I'm about to call a semi-final or an elimination final. Oh, right. What time will you be back? About 9 o'clock. Then, of course, we had extra time. So 9:45, I got another phone call. Just wondering what time you'll be back, Mr. Hill. Our hotel employee has been out for a 4-hour dinner and would really like to go home. Poor guy. He had his car. I mean, good job I didn't crash it or get a parking ticket or something.
Well, lucky it wasn't the police calling you saying you've stolen someone's car.
Well, lucky Ben Halloran found the back of the net. He would have waited an hour, maybe more.
Good fella. Yeah. Penalties would have been a nightmare for him.
Speaking of that, let's get into it.
Is this the moment? Ben Halloran! The goal that probably sends Adelaide to Perth next Friday, Cooper Stadium, a wall of sound. Joy and ecstasy on behalf of the Reds and their coach, Marco Kurtz.
The goal that meant the hotel employee had half an hour left to wait for his car. Awesome scenes. Ben Halloran's winner. Adelaide moved through and play Perth on Friday night in the semi-final. I really enjoyed the game. I thought it was tense. Of course, there could have been more chances. It could have been a little bit prettier, but I thought the defensive quality from both sides, as we expect from those two teams, was pretty good. Everything looked fantastic, the pitch, the crowd, and then the late winner. I thought it was just a really tense game of football the whole way through and found it pretty gripping.
Look, I did as well. Obviously, I was calling the game, so I was invested in it, and I think everybody was inside the stadium. Yeah, you'll see more aesthetically pleasing games of football this season, but you know, Robbie and I were talking in the green room before we came in about it's about this emotional investment in a team and the league on a wider level. I think too many people, I get what you're referring to, is a lot of people have said to you on your social media platforms, oh, it was a terrible game and I didn't enjoy it, it's crap. And, you know, there's a lot of people who are very quick to hang you-know-what on the A-League. Mm. It's that lack of emotional connection to teams and the league that causes those opinions. I thought the game was, as you pointed out, tense. Intense. There wasn't a lot of goalmouth action. I mean, really, that sums up the two team seasons. They are the lowest scoring two sides in the top six. They've struggled to hit the back of the net and they struggled to create chances. But overall, I thought it was a gripping encounter. It was one of those battles. Both teams had their periods of domination. I think in the end, just about the right team won.
Yeah, I think so. As you say, a few people maybe didn't think it was the most entertaining game. But if you looked at the two seasons that the sides have had, all the statistics, the way they matched up, it was always going to be one goal that was going to win it. And I suppose that's the beauty of the contest, to know that if one person slips up, one brilliant ball or through ball, and someone finds the back of the net, then that could just about seal the game. And that's where the tension and sort of the beauty of the game comes into it, I think.
It's funny, I was watching it while doing Bill and Boz, and Stuart Clark, the cricketer, was next to me, and we're watching it, and during an ad break we said, this is going to penalties. Both teams have absolutely buggered here. But all it takes is one little mistake, and Richie Delatt doesn't collect a ball that goes through because he's fatigued. You could tell how tired the teams were. Fatigue leads to a mistake. And you can almost sense Craig Goodwin thinking, this is the chance. We're not going to get another one. There have been barely any chances in extra time. We've got to make the most of this. And he had a wonderful game, and he puts in a brilliant ball. Diawara tees up Halloran. Gleckovic should do better, but he finishes. I mean, they took their opportunity when it presented itself for the most important moment, didn't they?
Well, yeah, like you say, there's two sides to that. I mean, the fatigue showed by Delatt, unable to get to that ball, and then the calmness and the cool heads of Adelaide from all three of them. Goodwin could have just slung it in, but he cut inside, looked for a better option. Diawara held the ball up well, could have turned and hit it.
Yep.
Had another runner that he could have played. It was a bit tight, but he summed it up well. And then once he rolled it to Halloran, his finish was one of composure. Went for the bottom corner, didn't try to blaze away. It wasn't a tired finish. And I think in the end, well, definitely, that was the difference.
I think, you know, the thing that needs to be praised here really is Adelaide's resilience, because what's probably been forgotten in the aftermath of that game is that they scored when Melbourne City were looking by far the likelier team to actually go on and win it. Adelaide looked horribly fatigued in that second period of extra time. It looked as though they were the team that were perhaps, you know, searching for penalty kicks to have a chance of going through. But they found a way. Mm. They did the same two or three weeks earlier against Melbourne Victory. They got a late goal through George Blackwood on that occasion. That's what Marco Kurtz has instilled in that squad, that they fight for their coach and for their club and for their badge. Well, and I think the fans helped them as well, to be honest.
I mean, a big crowd,
and they were very noisy.
Very interestingly, the last six games have kept four clean sheets, and it's almost a makeshift back four. Yep. No Jordan Elsie, meant a reshuffle, Moroney going into the middle.
Resisted the temptation to make those changes.
Exactly.
As well,
Ryan Kiddo's been playing left back, almost like found a new position, and Galloway's switched over, who's had a fantastic season as well. So it's not an established back four that's been there the whole season, but they've banded together, and as you say, Marco Kurtz has got them showing that resilience, that that understanding of one another, and so far they've been very good defensively over the last month and a half.
Now, how good is this IES?
He's fantastic. I was just going to say that, how good is Marco Kurtz? Why on earth get rid of him?
Well, as I understand it, the reason really is that they're going to cut costs next season. They're going to look at this development model, which I'm presuming is something akin to what the Mariners have been doing over the last couple of years, which, if that's true, and look, I heard it from a decent source, but I obviously I haven't spoken directly to Pete van der Poel or anybody else at the club and asked them direct. If that's true, then that's probably a bit disappointing.
Yeah.
And to be honest, to me, if that's going to be the case, and already we've got the Mariners who are sort of in that boat as well, there's rumours in the the New South Wales press this week that Martin Lee's going to cut his cloth accordingly because financially he's struggling a bit with his businesses. You know, Wellington don't often spend big. They don't go in the market for big marquees. If we're going to have four of the clubs that are going to say, well, we're going to just, you know, pull the reins in, then let's get rid of the salary cap. Let's get rid of it and let the big clubs go.
Yeah.
Because if the smaller clubs aren't going to bother, then the big clubs need to drive this.
Yeah.
So that's my opinion. Anyway, it's a theory at the moment.
Yeah.
But I would imagine if it is true, then that is why Marco Kurtz has said, I'm not having a bar of this, because I'm ambitious.
Yeah. Fair point. And the scenes last night were great. The way, before extra time, he walks over to the fans and he pumps them up. I mean, this is a guy who's won an FFA Cup, made the finals last year. They're now into a semi-final. The squad is solid but not spectacular. Could anyone else realistically have done any better?
He's done the best
better?
He can with that.
Surely.
No, I mean, he's been fantastic. I mean, you look at that. And the emotion side of things that you bring up, Adelaide obviously had Josip Gumba as well, who brought that. And we've had a few over the years in the A-League that do show that. And whether you're a good coach or a bad coach, fans want to see that. It's entertaining. It shows that they're invested in the game, that they really care. And, you know, if Adelaide are looking to cut costs, you can understand, like you say, why he wants to leave. He's got more ambition than that. And with the budget that they have spent this year, it's not huge. you just see where they are on the table. If they just kept the same budget or spent just a touch more, they could be a real contender. Yeah. But it looks as though they might try to go the other way.
The only thing I'll say about Kurtz, I love his passion as well. I think he obviously, you know, lives and breathes his team, which is fantastic. I think sometimes he overdoes it on the sidelines.
Yeah, no doubt.
You know, there are a couple of incidents during the game on Sunday. He's in constant debate with the fourth official.
Yeah.
He got a yellow card for saying something. Kurt Ams booked him. I thought he had a pretty good game, by the way. But this constant berating of the officials and, you know, abusing them and I don't know. I think to me it's a little bit over the top. Passion, great, no problem. I know sometimes that boils over, but you can't have a running commentary with the officials for 90 minutes. Mm. And he seems to me to almost do that.
Yep. We'll talk about Melbourne City a bit later on because a lot of the Twitter questions were about Warren Joyce
and
Melbourne
who?
City and where they're at. So we'll leave that for later on. We'll also look at the semi-final matchup after we look at the first elimination final. So we'll have a closer inspection on Perth against Adelaide. But the victory stepped things up a gear, which they needed to on Friday night. I mean, Kevin Muscat said leading into the finals, we're not going to win it the way we're going right now. But if they clicked in that first final, who knows? And they did. We can talk about Wellington and you know, where they're at the moment and whether the Rudin effect had an impact on them. But, you know, the big players step up in finals and by gee, Ole Toivonen did that. Wasn't he a pleasure to watch on Friday night? Just a cut above everyone else in the pitch, wasn't he?
Yeah, he certainly was. And having looked at the game again, I watched it live and I've watched a lot of the clips again. I can say even if he didn't score and he didn't assist, he probably still would have been the best player on the park because some of the work that he did off the ball, it really helped Melbourne Victory in the way that they set up. They got a lot of numbers behind the ball, let the Wellington back four have the ball quite comfortably. And when they got into that Victory half, that's when they pressed. And Toivonen was one of the first players to really make the Wellington team sweat. Any heavy touch he was there, he won the free kick for the goal. He was able to pinch the ball a couple of times, in particular off Mandy. Second half, that led to a goal as well. And I just think his energy, his unselfishness to work for the team, because he is a laid-back character, and you do get the impression of maybe he's just strolling around on the park. But the work that he put in, and I think Costa Barbarousos touched on it as well in his interview after the game, saying his unselfishness, his runs off the ball to create space, I thought he was absolutely fantastic.
Is he arguably the best pedigreed striker we've ever had in the A-League? Now, I say that considering Del Piero and Dwight York came at the end of their careers. Toivonen came after scoring in a World Cup
David
Sweden
Villa.
Against Germany. Mm. David Villa, but he wasn't here for very long, was he? It was
Tim
a short
Cale.
Stint. Timmy, also towards the end of his career. You look at...
Harry Kuehl.
He's not far off his prime, Ole Toivonen. Yeah. You know, Berisha and these guys, but you match up contribution with status in the game, he could be just about top of the pops.
Well, whether he is or he's not, he's certainly a quality player and we need more of his ilk. And, you know, I'd just get a big round of applause to Melbourne Victory because they recognise that they're a big club and that they need to invest in those sorts of players. Bringing in Keisuke Honda and Toivonen and two big marquee players that have had a big impact on the league. And remember, you know, Toivonen has missed probably about a quarter of the season through injuries, various ones. So imagine how many goals he would have had had he been fit to play, you know, pretty much every game. I think he's been brilliant. And that's why I give, you know, Victory still a big chance of retaining their crown because they've got those big game players. obviously, they've got a tough game to come against Sydney. I know we'll talk about that later. But I think, you know, with the Champions League, Kevin Muscat has the opportunity now to rest some of those senior stars and get them really right for Sunday. So it's going to be fascinating, isn't it, Sunday?
Just still on Toivonen, and I brought this up on Friday night. We do bemoan because of the foreigners who come in and take striking spots, the fact that Aussie players don't get opportunities in those positions. That leads to problems with the Socceroos, a more than valid argument, of course. But at least you can't argue with the quality of the foreign strikers coming through. If those players were just doing a job, then you'd really get annoyed about it. But when you've got Toivonen, Krishna, Andy Keogh, what he's done over the last few years, Adam Lafondra, when you consider his season, Costa Barbarousas, at least they're thrilling us week in, week out.
Yeah, they've all got on the score sheet, all doing what they've paid to do, and they're leading by example. You know, you do say maybe it slows the development of some players, but there is enough A-League clubs out there that have gone with a local lineup, Central Coast Mariners, obviously Adelaide United, they've
Brisbane have
trialed with both. Jamie McLaren's getting his chance at Melbourne City, but the ones that have come in have really done their job. You can't say Maybe other than Jair, who played a lot out wide, it might be a little bit harsh, although he is a bit more of a number nine. I think every other foreign striker is just about delivered.
I think the issue really for certainly Graham Arnold, the national team, is it's those young strikers. I mean, you mentioned Jamie McLaren, yeah, but he's, what, 25, 26? I mean, he's established. Yep. We already know what Jamie can do at national team level and at A-League level. What you're looking to see is maybe, and I'll just pick one name out, Apostolos Stamatolopoulos, get a regular go, leading the line for Adelaide United, because he's that age group that you want to see that next generation coming through and starting to score regularly in the A-League. What? It's difficult, though, because, you know, all the clubs, we demand marquees and big name players, and if you're going to go down that road, they're normally strikers or attacking players, aren't they?
Yeah.
And yet we want to see development for the players. The answer, of course, is a bigger league and a second division, so we get more opportunities.
Well, the other one's Nick D'Agostino, went away with the under-23s.
Yeah. He's another
banged in a couple of goals, but didn't find a regular starting position at Brisbane Roar.
Wenzel Hall's got a chance, though.
Yeah, he did, and he took it with both hands.
And that, of course, happened because Adam Taggart left, who was another Aussie. So there are some, but at least the players who are coming in, the majority of them are certainly earning their paychecks. Put yourself in the Wellington Phoenix dressing room, Robbie Cornthwaite. You find out a month or so ago, it was confirmed that Mark Rudin's leaving. He's handled it the right way. He's been as honest and transparent as he could possibly be, honest with his players. Putting all that into the equation, how much of an impact does it still have on your ability to deliver when it matters?
Well, there's a perfect example at Adelaide United. We spoke about it a little bit last night before the kickoff, and it wasn't so much whether a coach is staying or going. It's just the question of what's going to happen. So I think once that question's answered, there should be really no issue. I mean, obviously some players may have re-signed or committed to the club thinking he might stay. That could have put a few noses out of joint. But once the players know the decision, there's no doubt in your mind whether he's staying or going. I think you should have been able to get on with the job. Obviously, Wellington, it's affected them the opposite way to Adelaide. Adelaide have lifted and they've dropped off. But what I can say is, from the game on Friday night against Victory, they weren't poor.
Yeah.
Victory were very good in the way they set up, and we have to start giving teams a bit more credit that try to make the play. It's a lot easier to sit back and defend and then hit teams on the counter. If you've got the ball the whole time trying to create opportunities, that's a lot more difficult. So full credit to Wellington for taking that on. I thought they had enough of the ball to create something, which they didn't. And they can just say on the day they were beaten by a better side. I don't think it was tactically outsmarted or anything along those lines. I thought they went into the game with a good plan. And they've had a good season. Just at the end, the wheels have fell off. They've run out of steam.
Would it affect you, though, as a player, knowing that the coach is taking another job in the A-League, that he's almost running out on your club for another opportunity in the league? Would that have a bit of an impact?
I don't think so. I mean, every player is different. I'm not trying to think of an example if that's happened previously. Mm. Was it Ange Postecoglou? Did he announce Melbourne before he left? I'm not sure.
I think he announced it before.
Maybe Berisha did. But yeah, for me, I don't think it would have any effect.
Okay.
Obviously, if you love that manager and you really want to play for that manager, obviously you're going to be disappointed. Mm. But I think you should be professional enough to be able to get on with the job. You've got a final to play, for goodness sake.
Yeah. Well, they still had a pretty good season, didn't they? And overachieved.
But much better than the last one.
Let's
be honest. It's funny, you know, I did a radio interview for a New Zealand station over the weekend, and there's a little bit of angst over there about the appointment of Ufuk Tale as their new coach. Not anything personal against Ufi, but I think their feeling over there is perhaps a little bit what we feel over here when a foreign coach comes in and takes over an A-League club, and everybody's now saying, well, you know, why isn't it a Kiwi coach? So I think they've sort of got to the point in time where, and this is this radio guy who was speaking to me about it, that, you know, they see an Aussie coach coming in. What do they know about Kiwi football? And do they represent, you know, the New Zealand way of playing? They only stick around for 12 months and then they're off.
Mm.
Which I thought was an interesting point.
Yeah.
I don't know who would be the candidates. Ramon Tribulatics obviously is one name that keeps popping up whenever that job becomes vacant. I'm not sure he's got the requisite coaching badges, to be honest, or whether he'd leave Auckland City. Danny Hay was another name mentioned. But anyway, it's Tallow they've gone with, and wish him good luck.
What do you make of the job that he's been given? Do you feel as though he's ready?
Well, he's had a good apprenticeship, hasn't he?
I mean,
he's had a year as an assistant to Steve Corica, but before that, he's been with the Australian junior teams. I mean, Uffy was, you know, a very good player. He's got all his badges. So, I mean, the proof is in the pudding, isn't it? We'll see how well he goes next year, but I think he probably deserves an opportunity. And from an Australian point of view, obviously it's good to see it. You know, that one of the next generation get a chance.
And obviously Mark Rudin deserves a little bit of credit too, because he's gone over there done a fantastic job and opened up the door.
Yeah. I think he's recommended him as
well. He would have. They're good friends, and they've worked together before.
Well, there you go. So, I mean, yes, you want to consider – you want the best candidate, regardless of where they're from. So if they feel that maybe Ufuk Tale's got similar attributes to Mark Rudin and that's the role and the road they want to continue to go down, then it seems like a smart appointment.
Big shoes to fill. Good luck to him. All right, let's take a close look at the semi-finals. Friday night, Perth against Adelaide. Glory have had the weekend off. They've had a bit of a scare in that time, though. Neil Kilkenny has suffered an ankle injury. We don't know how serious that is at this stage. The early reports were he could be out for the final. Some people at Perth are saying it's not too bad. He should be okay. We don't quite know at this stage that it'd obviously be a big blow. But how do you look at it, Robbie? Adelaide playing 120 minutes, but having this momentum and the underdog status that they'll play on all week to take into this game against a Glory side that, you know, will be under pressure to deliver straight away.
Yeah, well, that's the key talking point, isn't it? I mean, Adelaide United, nothing to lose, really. They can go over there, give it their best. If they don't get the result, then they don't lose anything from that. So, as you say, you don't know how Perth are going to respond after the week off. We don't know whether they've had a few days off and then given a real heavy training load or whether they've just been completely freshened up. There has been a bit of talk, as you mentioned, about Adelaide having to travel, 5-day turnaround, 120 minutes. But, you know, what I would say to that is Adelaide just had a 10-day break.
Yeah.
They played on Anzac Day, the Thursday, had 10 days to prepare for Melbourne City, and now they've got another 5. So two games in 15 days with the extra time, I don't think that's a lot to ask for. And as you say, Perth Glory at home, they're playing for that grand final. And Bruce Gitte mentioned last night that when they played Melbourne City and they got that 4-1 win, that motivation of knowing you're going to have a grand final at home in front of your own fans, he said that spurred on the Adelaide side so much, and that's what he feels got them over the line.
Brings with it some pressure, though.
It does, but I think they can handle it, Perth. The issue for me, for Adelaide, well, twofold. Firstly is the fatigue. I get Robbie's point that, you know, you should be able to play two games in 15 days. That's correct. But it is a short turnaround. They've got the travel on the back of that as well. The other issue for me, and the main one really, is how are they going to score against Perth? It took them 19 minutes to break through against Melbourne City. They played Perth 3 times this season. They haven't scored against them, even though they got a goalless draw over in the West in the middle part of the season. But, you know, Perth are a different unit these days. This is not the Perth of old that had the soft centre. This is a very strong, structured unit. And I just can't see how Adelaide are going to make a breakthrough.
Finals, the tickets there for the final are apparently tracking really well. So it should be a bumpy crowd as well. Mm. But yeah, Adelaide, you can just see them. They're the perfect club for that backs to the wall mentality, aren't they? And that first 20 minutes for mine is going to be crucial. If the Glory are a little bit cold coming out, having had a week off, I don't think they will be, but if they are, Adelaide will grow a little bit into the game and it might just play into their hands. We know how strong they are.
Who replaces? So if Kilkenny's not fit, Jake Brimmer?
I think it'd be one day and it'd be a showdown between Brimmer and Wilson, you would think.
Mm. Brandon Wilson's not featured of late.
Yeah, so I think Brimmer's got the inside running, which would be a big game for him to play in. I mean, hasn't quite taking his chances at the Glory, but he keeps getting chances, so the coaches might be seeing something in him.
Has Popper got a surprise up his sleeve? Is he going to put Spira maybe in the holding role?
Ooh, big call. That's almost as big as Andy Harper on Sunday night.
Saying that one.
He should put Jordan Elsie up front.
Then you've got two real holders in Spira in one day. Maybe you lose a little bit of creativity, but it's possible. You'd think Brimmer would get the job. Anyway, hopefully Neil Kilkenny's right because he's had a fantastic season.
Good shout there, Robbie.
Then we've got the Big Blue on Sunday. What a game this is going to be. Sydney against Victory. Last year was one of the most epic football matches I've ever seen. Never mind, just in Australia. It had everything. Another dose of that would be awesome.
Well, how many times are we going to see the Terry Antonis goal this week, do you think, in the lead up to that game? But rightly so. I mean, it's the third year in a row. I think they've played off one apiece in the previous two encounters in the finals. So it's all set up for a massive occasion on Sunday night. Obviously, both with Asian Champions League during the week, both travelling, but very different situations in their ACL campaign. Sydney with all to play for. Melbourne, they're officially out, I think. So sent a bit of a skeleton squad away to Korea. So obviously, they've got the upper hand there. James Troisi possibly as well coming back from injury. Yeah, it's going to be an interesting battle. Sydney at home is always difficult, but Melbourne Victory after that performance against Wellington Phoenix. So they're just about putting their noses in front, I think.
This is the fixture that stirs the blood, I think, more than even the derbies for both teams. And that's, you just mentioned that game last year, that semi-final. I mean, wow, that was just epic. Absolutely epic. As a commentator, you know, they're brilliant games to call as well, because there's always drama, always, be it, you know, great goals or fallings out on the pitch and send-offs, and it's just a fantastic fixture. It's you know, it's the marquee fixture of the league for me.
Well, I was talking to Adam Lafondra on Friday, and we did an interview which will be shown in the lead-up to this game, I think, and he was saying exactly that. The players, they love the derby, they want to beat the Wanderers, but you could tell when he came into that squad, this was the game that got the experienced players like an Alex Brosk, Brandon O'Neill, et cetera, fired up more than any other. The game against
Victory. You know, Georg Niedermeyer, when he signed for Melbourne Victory, to get himself in the right psychology of playing in the A-League and what it meant, and he actually sought out tapes of you know, the big games, and he watched the Big Blue. That was the fixture he watched and went, that's it. Mm. That's what I want to play in.
Fantastic. The Musket Corica aspect to it, because Muskie's been here and done it. He knows how to set himself, his team for finals. He's probably building them to this moment. And Steve Corica, as excellent as he's been this season, we've praised him. He hasn't been in this position before, this level of intensity with the eyes on him and up against someone like Muskie, who knows what to say in the media, put a couple of little barbs out there that might just have an impact. Graham Arnold had been there and done it. That'll be a test for him, won't it?
Yeah. Sorry, go on, Robbie.
No, I'm just going to say you're exactly right. I'm sure he's been around as a player enough to know how to handle a final situation. And I think it's maybe a good thing that they've got a game this week in the midweek, a big fixture in the ACL, because it kind of distracts a little bit. I'm sure he's not talking too much about the Big Blue on Sunday. It's not until they get back from overseas, which is probably Thursday, and then it's a very quick turnaround, freshen up. I think that actually could be a little bit of an advantage.
You know, you mentioned Muskie putting barbs in the media. I remember that semi-final last year. It was actually Graham Arnold who said something. Mm. And I can't remember the specifics of it. But Arnie said something in the media, and I know that Muskie was really seriously angry about it. And he used that as motivation for his team. I'm not sure it was disrespectful, but it was a very confident Graham Arnold, you know, that they had the better record against Victory or something like that. And Muskie used that a lot in the build-up. So if Corica's wise, maybe he'll just keep it zipped.
A salivating semi-final lineup: Perth, Adelaide Friday night, Sydney against Victory, the Big Blue semi on Sunday. Of course, the only place to watch it is on Fox Sports. Right, let's shift away from the A-League finals.
I've just remembered. And it wasn't actually the fight. It was all the stuff about the guard of honour for the Sydney FC winning the Premier's play. Right. Do you remember? Arnie said, you know, he asked if Victory are going to do a guard of honour. And Muskie, of course, was like, how can I do that?
Yes, that's right.
All how can I do that that's with Melbourne right. Victory? I can't do that. It was great stuff.
That game had everything. Reece Williams got injured before the game. Yeah, the coaches came on and had a fight with David Carney. I mean, it was just...
John Paul de Marini.
You could do an ESPN 30 for 30 on it. It was that good. Speaking of ESPN and American stuff, take a listen to this, because I found this very interesting over the weekend.
I think American soccer fans are the most educated, sophisticated, and interesting fans in the world. Out of necessity, when you grow up in a country and a culture where soccer isn't king, you're forced to seek out the game in a different and a unique way, because you can't count on it coming to you. In the US, soccer isn't ubiquitous. It's not part of mainstream media. It's not ingrained in our collective history. So American soccer fans become true citizens of the soccer world. They often think globally and act locally. Now, when it comes to watching soccer, as we all know on television, there is a dizzying orgy of choices. Our country's wonderful diversity has meant that Americans are exposed to a wide array of different soccer views, styles, and cultures, and that is reflected in our unique fandom. A typical American soccer fan will support a domestic club team, a national team, either the U.S. or other, an international club team, often teams from multiple foreign leagues, a college team, a youth club. That is a pretty expansive and cosmopolitan soccer palette. Your typical daily American soccer discussion is eclectic and can veer from Michael Bradley to Mo Salah to Alex Morgan to TV ratings to Messi to funding soccer-specific stadiums to team branding to promotion relegation to expansion fees to pay-to-play to sports law to NWSL to USL to NISA to Bundesliga, La Liga, Serie A, EPL, and more. This country has raised a generation of soccer fans steeped not in one soccer, but in all soccer. And in doing so, we've created a unique soccer culture where a wide breadth of knowledge is expected, celebrated, and necessary.
God bless America.
That was Alexi.
I think the only league he didn't mention was the A-League, wasn't it? Wow.
Alexi Lalas, former American captain, of course, their skipper at USA 94.
Still
their
calls
home
it
World
soccer.
Wasn't that familiar, a lot of that, for an Australian football fan?
Yeah.
Also, I think there's a lot of similarities.
Them, yeah, absolutely. Also makes them hypercritical of the local competition, though. That's the problem.
Yeah, it does from time to time. But I think his point was, you know, you're just forced to take in so much that, you know, you become very knowledgeable. And that often leads to you being, yeah, hypercritical of things. They don't seem to have the political issues
that
we have.
The point I'm making here is that if you're living, say, for example, in Slovenia, you're probably aware of, you know, big leagues of Europe, maybe not to the same depth as the American or the Australian fan, but does that make you as hypercritical of your local competition as we are in Australia of the A-League?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
I doubt it.
I don't live in Slovenia. I mean, some of those countries are very critical of their local league. I remember being in Norway last year and they were saying the exact same things. They're obsessed with the Premier League and they criticise their league a lot because it's not the Premier League. So you do get that. But I want to look at the positive of that. I mean, that's what I found interesting. You know, the positive aspect of all of this, not the negative, that we are in Australia, like the Americans, you know, football fans with a very diverse knowledge base because it's not the only sport like it is in so many countries in Europe.
Are we talking other sports? Oh, I just thought we're talking other leagues.
No, but that's what his point is. Because of the sports dynamic there, they are forced to bring in their knowledge from so many different parts of the world. Whereas if you live in England, you don't really, you watch a bit of the other leagues, but it's just football.
How do you know?
What do you mean?
How do you know what people watch?
Well, it's not about what people watch. It's about the dynamic of the country.
Okay. How do you know? I know you lived in England, but how do you know what people think and talk about around the water cooler?
Well, I know what the sport landscape is there because I live there.
Yeah.
And the sport landscape is football dominated, which is great. In America and Australia, we have a different...
Okay. I'm still not getting the point here. Are you talking about other sports or are you just talking about other leagues?
We're talking about the knowledge of a football fan in Australia and America, which I think is very similar.
Yeah, you're saying that because, well, and what Alexi Lalas is basically saying is because it's a lot harder to source information, we do sort of go out there and learn a lot more about other leagues.
Yeah.
Because it's not all mainstream. It's not always on the news about the Bundesliga and about the Serie A and about La Liga. So
correct.
We're quite often sourcing or looking for information about these leagues and it's information that we might bring back and try to implement into our own league, which many of us feel can improve in many different areas. I mean, that's what I take from it. I don't know about American football fans being the most sophisticated football fans in the world.
That's a typical American type response.
I think a lot of Australian football fans would have a broad knowledge, whether it's deep or more sort of superficial about a lot of leagues rather than an in-depth knowledge of just one league. I think that's what I take from that.
I don't know.
What issue do you take with what he had to say?
I don't know. I don't live in America, so I don't know about American football fans. I'm thinking about the comparison with Australia. I think a lot of football fans in Australia, yes, I mean, obviously the Premier League's very popular here, Bundesliga, La Liga, some of the other European leagues to a certain extent. I think that depends largely on your ethnic heritage as well. I think that's a big factor. I think there's a lot of football fans who think they know a lot about, say, for example, you know, Asian football is all crap. No, exactly. but that's a, you know, that's a common conception that you hear. Oh, we should be beating the UAE. We should be beating Vietnam. We should be doing this, that, and the other. But is there any real depth of knowledge? I'm not saying I necessarily have it, but is there any real depth of knowledge about, you know, football in those areas? Or are we talking just the major European leagues? I tend to think that there is a good knowledge of the Premier League and maybe some of the other European leagues. I'm not sure about the rest of the leagues around the world.
You have to think about how many leagues there are in the world. It's going to be impossible to be across every single league.
But he's not saying they're across every league. What he's saying is because it's not the football's not the dominant sport in their country and it's not in ours. You take in different aspects of football. Yeah. You go to the Australian League, we take in all these different leagues. It doesn't mean you have to be an expert in all those leagues, but you absorb different aspects of it. And his point is that makes you quite an intelligent football fan. It doesn't make Australians the most intelligent football fans in the world, just like it doesn't make Americans, which I don't agree with that point.
I think what you're saying...
He says we think globally, act locally. And that was the point that was interesting. And that, for me, sometimes is a problem with Australian football. As much as I take the positives out of what he said, because we have this global insight into football, we then put that into a local sphere. And sometimes the melting pot can boil over because everyone's got these ideas from world football into sometimes a pie that's not too big in Australia. And it can sometimes bubble over.
I'm going to just change it up a little bit. I played and lived in Malaysia for 3 years. It's a very similar sort of landscape. They love the English Premier League. It's on every channel every day. It's, fan TV, all that. Bundesliga, the same sort of thing. And then they try to implement all those things that they see into the local league, but it just doesn't fit, you know what I mean? So it's one thing to say, let's learn all these things, let's know all these things, but you have to know what is the right thing for your league. There might be something we do in the A-League or through the FFA that's not been done anywhere else in the world, but that's what's... works for our league. So I think it's important to look at these other successful leagues and really understand whether that, you know, round peg fits into a square hole in Australia or a round hole. You know, don't just try to force everything through the same hole. It's got to be unique to our situation.
Yeah.
I think it can suffer by comparison, can't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you look at the big European leagues, even the leagues in South America, obviously, you know, the A-League is, it's not the Premier League. We know that. But that doesn't necessarily make it a poor competition. And certainly in comparison to, for example, a lot of other leagues in Europe. I've been lucky enough to call, a few countries around the world, particularly in Europe. And some of the games I've done, for example, in Serie A, and people go, oh, no, it's one of the best leagues in the world. Well, yeah, at the top level, it is. Mm. You watch Juventus against Napoli or Inter or AC Milan, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've called Chievo against Siena, and it was rubbish, quite honestly. Same as, you know, Fulham against Huddersfield is rubbish.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's sometimes I think that knowledge can be a dangerous thing because people tend to assume that our league's just rubbish in comparison. Well, some of the games are, but some of them are really good.
Yeah.
So it's not a binary choice, is it? Or it shouldn't be.
Yeah. Anyway, I liked what he had to say
because it
made me
very
think, you know, as Australian football fans, we do have a level of insight into the game that is unique. And it's different to other fans around the world, and we should celebrate that sometimes. It causes us problems, but there are a lot of positive aspects to it. It doesn't make us the best in the world, like Alexi said about America, but it does make us unique and for mine, insightful. So, yeah, I thought that was interesting. Anyway, Jared Gillett debuted in the championship overnight. What a moment for him. Blackburn Swansea 2-2 got his first chance. So that was great for an Aussie abroad. Hopefully he gets
your
more
club,
games.
Robbie.
Yeah, I didn't see too much of the game. I saw the result too, all obviously last game of the season. Good for him to get his opportunity, and let's hope if he continues to referee in the championship, if not the Premier League, that at some point the Australian Football Referees Committee or whatever the umbrella they come under, the FFA, they reach out to him and keep in touch with him and sort of keep their finger on the pulse and what's happening around the rest of the world in the refereeing circles.
Who got his first yellow card? Do we know?
No, I did look to see if there was any controversial moments. So I was thinking there was only two yellow cards or something like that.
It was Bradley Dack, who then scored three minutes later.
He'll go to the Premier League, I'm telling you now, lads. Blackburn number 10 on fire.
He only issued two yellow cards. Bradley Dack got one in the 44th minute and Cameron Carter-Vickers in the 69th. 16,227 people at Ewood Park.
Do you reckon he got a bit of grief?
I don't know, at Ewood probably.
For being an Aussie at in the English league?
No, we've got Aussie's got a good reputation at Ewood Park, the likes of Neil Greller, Emerton,
exactly.
Robbie Slater, very own Robbie Slater. So Aussies are well liked at Ewood.
He's the first foreigner to referee in England.
I wasn't aware
of
that.
In the English Football League, the first foreigner. Well, amazing, isn't it?
Very.
So well done to Jared Gillett.
Good on him.
Tom Rogic won the league again. Celtic, their eighth straight. I mean, they had to work a little bit harder this season through the middle part, but another title for Tommy. Well done. Danny Vukovic flying in Belgium. They're set to win the title there. What a season he's had. Look forward to celebrating that in a couple of weeks. Let's go into the Premier League now because we've got the title and the top four race to look at, and both have been pretty illuminating.
Lussell getting it forward quickly. Shaw has missed it. Big moment from Benza. It is 1-1. How important the goal for Pep proved to be in the race for a place in the top four. And Benza at the end of Route 1 for Huddersfield Town. Manchester United back on level terms. And their malaise continues.
Does it ever? Oh boy, Manchester United. You thought we would have started with the title race in England, but considering what happened in the top four race, I think this takes precedence. It's pretty much done now. Chelsea and Tottenham will play Champions League football next season. Arsenal has to win the Europa League if they want to. Manchester United won't. They are going to finish sixth. How do you draw with all that on the line away to a team that is already relegated and has had one of the worst single season performances in Premier League history?
Well, because they're a mess.
They're a shambles.
They're an absolute mess. And Solskjaer knows he's got a big rebuilding job to do. They had that little spike when he took over, which sometimes happens with a new coach. He obviously, you know, made it a much more harmonious camp. But it's the senior players who are not standing up. Alexis Sanchez got a rare start. No impact. Injured. Will miss the last game of the season. Their best player on the day was Scott McTominay, a youngster that's come through the ranks, scored their goal, not just the goal. They've got to spend big just to get back within range of the top teams. You look at the gap now between United and City and Liverpool, and that Manchester derby, you know, a week or two ago, just underlined how big the gap was because City won that game at a canter. They had 15 minutes at the start of the game where they pushed a bit, but City won that game very easily indeed. So United have got a massive problem, and it's Europa League for them. Now, it could even be, you know, if Watford were to win the cup final against City, that United would have to come back early to go through the qualifying rounds for the Europa League. That would be very embarrassing for them.
I mean, is there a case that, you know, if United did, I know they can't now, but if they did manage to finish in the top four, that would have given them a false sort of sense of where they're at? I mean, is this showing them now that you're finishing sixth, you're only one spot above
the
Wolves, this is rock bottom.
Yeah, maybe.
This is rock bottom. Obviously, on the flip side, you haven't got the financials coming in from the Champions League. You say now it's harder to attract players, and then you've got Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, who's never been in charge of a club of this magnitude, in charge of the transfers. Well, we think he's going to have a say. Obviously, Ed Woodward's going to have a say as well, whose track record's not the greatest.
That might change.
Who's going to have a say if it's not Woodward and Solskjaer?
Woodward and Solskjaer will do it together. But if I was a United fan, I'd be seriously worried. And you're right, maybe they didn't need to hit rock bottom to have a full understanding of the severity of their situation. But, you know, they've got a manager who has not, as you said, he hasn't been in the situation. You know, when Emery went to Arsenal and Pochettino went to Spurs and Sarri went to Chelsea and Klopp went to Liverpool, the fans went, all right, at least we've got a manager who's been through this before. They've been at a big club. They can deal with the pressure. Solskjaer's managed in Norway. Nothing against them, but it's worlds away. He hasn't dealt with player transfers and trying to attract big names. He hasn't dealt with trying to get rid of big names.
Yeah.
He's got to split up that dressing room. The reports out of the UK suggest that Paul Pogba, one of the biggest names, is toxic in that dressing room. He's taking players like some of the reports from the weekend, Martial and Rashford and Lingard, and he's leading them astray, and that they're not committing themselves and they're joking around and they don't realise how serious this is.
Yeah.
He's got to deal with that. Well, he's got to bring them all together and tell some big-name players and try and sell them. Jeez, it's going
to
be tough.
Here's a question. How many transfer windows is it going to take for Manchester United to get back to not even competing for the top two, but just to be comfortably in the top four?
Three minimum.
Yeah, you would think it would take a while. But, I mean, you never know with these things. It can be corrected in one window if you get it all right. It's a big ask, but if they sign two or three players and do what Liverpool did and get a Firmino or a Salah and find a few gems and a then it can change very quickly. But the question mark I would have as a United fan is this manager equipped to do it? Not saying he won't be, but there's no proof that he can. Whereas the other managers around the top six have all been there. Sarri was successful at Napoli. Emery was successful in Spain. Klopp, obviously, at Liverpool before. Pochettino, a bit different, but he'd been in big changing rooms and in big leagues before.
I mean, just on Emery, they're only 1 point ahead of Manchester United. And, you know, their squad, for me, is probably a little bit better than that of Manchester United's at the moment. You think they've only won three games all season away from home. I think they were against Watford and Huddersfield. And one in the cup or something along those lines. That's absolutely disastrous for a club of that side. That away form, 100% has cost them a place in the top four.
They've been pathetic as well. Arsenal, 4 points from their last 18, 4 defeats in 6. United, 8 points from their last 24, 4 defeats in 8. Tottenham, 10 points from their last 33, 7 defeats in 11. I mean, we used to joke about Stephen Bradbury a week or two ago. This is Stephen Bradbury. They have fallen over the line, Tottenham.
I mean, that 100%. I mean, 100%. I think once they realised the title race was over for them, it probably the Champions League became the focus. Certainly on the weekend, they would have been looking towards Ajax, that second leg away from home. I think it's this week. They are going to finish in the top four. Fourth, they, like we say, they were title contenders at one stage, and now they're 24 points behind. So they've fallen into a massive slump. And as you say about Stephen Bradbury, nobody wanted to finish in the top four by the looks of things.
Well, Chelsea have done.
they've also skated through.
Yeah, they've skated through. I actually think the interesting thing about Chelsea is, you know, if they get to the final of the Europa League, which, I mean, they could win it, they could play Arsenal in the final. Mm. They're 1-1 with Eintracht Frankfurt after the first leg, Arsenal 3-1 up against Valencia. So it could be an all-London Europa League final. If Chelsea win that Europa League, does that count as a good season for Sarri? Despite all the stuff that he's been through, they got to the Carabao Cup final, they've qualified for next year's Champions League, and theoretically they win the Europa League. I know it's not, you know, the biggest baubles, but for a first season in charge, given that, you know, he's finding his way in the Premier League, I don't think that's too bad for all the grief he's had.
They win the Europa League, I reckon it's a decent season. I'd give Spurs definitely a pass as well, considering they didn't invest anything. You know, they didn't have any money to play with Pochettino, didn't bring in a player. The Champions League semi-finals, they can still make the final.
Yep.
So Spurs, I think we've been a bit harsh on just because of the dramatic way in which they've fallen away in the league. But
all those teams have had
the others, no.
positive seasons, with the exception of United.
Arsenal, I don't think, have been positive.
Well, Arsenal were coming from a long way back. If Arsenal win the Europa League, is that a successful season?
If they
win
the Europa League, it's a tick.
It's one game. It's one game to define how.
And it gets them into the Champions
football,
League.
It gets them
into the Champions League. But they've also invested a lot. Aubameyang and Lacazette. They've got a good squad.
Yeah.
Emery, look, I think they'll get a lot better, but
they need to fix the defence.
They haven't improved on last season.
Yeah.
Still soft as butter through the middle.
They haven't improved on last season. Chelsea, you can see some slightly better signs in the back end, but you're right, United have been the major fall-off, and that's concerning. Right, the title race, Liverpool. I thought they were gone against Newcastle. I thought it did look as though that was it. Salah had gone off, 2-2. They weren't creating much.
And the referee came to your rescue.
I was waiting for that.
Softest foul in history.
Listen, I put a lot of that onto the linesman. He's standing literally five yards away and he's waving his flag. You can see from the perfect angle, there's no contact whatsoever.
It's not like he gave a penalty. Shaqiri still had to put the perfect free kick in, and Origi still had to head it in the back of the net.
Apparently the linesman attracted the referee's attention. Hey, referee! Referee! It's a foul!
I can't get over how salty everyone is.
No, listen, I don't...
The anti-Liverpool bias.
Oh, come on!
Through the roof.
What absolute garbage. We had all week, we have had, could Brendan Rodgers do a title favour to his old club? We didn't hear anything about Benitez potentially tripping up his old club.
Yeah. I mean, I think
completely the other way.
I think the beautiful thing about this is the top four's done, the relegation's done. We're down to the final day, and all that's left to be decided is the title. So they've got centre stage now. Yeah. I think all the focus, even though it would have mainly been on them, there's no other distractions. It's purely, if Man City get the job done tonight, Monday night, then it's all down to them too.
Liverpool showed a lot of character to win that game, and that's the important thing. They've at least extended it to the final the final week. If they drew that, it was over. City wins against Leicester and it's done. So they've extended it to the final week and, you know, City will still have Brighton away, which, you know, could be a little bit tricky looking at the way Brighton played against Arsenal. But you'd imagine City would knock off Leicester and put themselves in pole position. I think they'll win quite comfortably, to be honest. They've had all week to prepare. But I did think at 2-2, that was it. Liverpool weren't showing signs that they're going to do what they've done for months.
But they found a way. They found a way, and they have done all season. So you've got to give them a lot of credit for that. They've been in that situation quite a few times, particularly since the turn of the year, where they've been level late on, needing a goal to keep up the pressure on Man City. And somehow they've found it almost every single time. So credit to them.
I mean, look, if Liverpool,
heck of a title race.
Liverpool win on Sunday, they'll finish with the third highest points total in the Premier League era. And who'll be the two teams above them? City last season, City this season.
So you're already saying City is finishing above you?
I think City will win it, yeah. I do. I think there could be a slip up. I'm not ruling it out, but I do think they will win it. I think they'll beat Leicester and they'll beat Brighton away. I mean, they've got too much talent. And that's not me trying to jinx them. I just think that'll happen.
Well, hopefully they're not listening to this and get extra pressure.
But it's been
I don't think Pep will be tuning in. Peter, no. Hi, Pep.
It's been absolutely epic, hasn't it?
It's been brilliant.
Well, we'll see what City can do against.
But it won't be if we don't win it.
Vardy on the counter attack. Maybe that can change it. Hey, Notts County got relegated, and I thought that's harsh on Harry Kewell.
Hey, he's not there.
I know. They were in the relegation spots when he was there. They were doing okay. They sacked him and they haven't moved.
Listen, I'm not going to pretend.
They gave him Garvey, 10 games.
I'm not going to pretend I know a lot about Notts County.
Nor do I.
And the way they play football. But certainly what I do know is when Harry Kewell was there, he was trying to implement a style of play. It was playing out from the back, trying to play football in these lower leagues. And I'm sure at the start, it's difficult. You concede. Who knows what would have happened in the long run? Maybe they would have played some attractive stuff and avoided relegation. We're never going to know. They made a change and absolutely nothing changed at the club. They've gone down after some... I think there was a lot of investment, if I'm not wrong, at the start of the season. So disappointing for them. For me, who knows if Harry would have made a difference.
But he kept Crawley Town up. So he'd shown he knows how to negotiate that league. He's given... Look, we're all talking in hindsight here. It means nothing in the end.
Of
course, but I just think it's hard. He'd be looking at it thinking... Did I deserve to lose my job when nothing's changed?
Oh, he didn't, but it was. I mean, anyway. It was very early on in the season, wasn't it? And with the greatest respect, just because he's Aussie doesn't mean he's got, you know, superhuman powers. He could be, to keep him up.
He could be from Senegal, for all I know, and he'd be looking at it going, that's harsh.
Yeah, no, I mean, he was. I mean, the sack was ridiculous. He'd only been there for 5 minutes, but I think it's a stretch to say, you know, he could have kept them up. Well, yeah, but so could another coach. Or another manager. But anyway, the biggest story for me is the fact that this is the oldest professional football club in the world. 157 years of unbroken membership of the Football League, as was, and now the pyramid system. And they've gone down. I mean, that's a piece of history gone. They were one of the founding members of the old First Division in 1888-89. So it's in many ways a tragic day for English football as well, because they're no longer a part of that elite club, but hopefully they will come back.
And an Aussie could have kept them up.
Who is the first Aussie to be involved at Notts County?
I've got no idea.
Here's your trick question.
Yeah. How long ago are we talking?
We're talking 80s.
I've got no chance.
Give me a clue.
Former national team coach.
Former national team coach.
This could be a long podcast.
Yeah, go on.
You're right there, Phil. You staying awake, mate?
I don't know.
Frank Farina.
Is he at Notts County?
Played three games online.
Really?
Now listen.
No, he's going
to. Before that goes to air, let me just check that I've got.
I don't remember
right.
Frank Farina ever playing for Notts County.
I think he played three games on loan, but I'm just going to check that. Just bear with me 1 second.
Three games on loan is very specific.
Make another cup of tea.
There are Aussies that have played at Notts.
There he is. Notts County, 1992, three games.
Oh, you got the error wrong, so that's why I didn't get it. I was thinking 80s.
Good one. There are a couple others that have played that. I didn't know Frank Farina had. Anyway, all right, let's get into some Twitter questions. This one from Jesse Jenkinson. After another season of mediocrity, how could Warren Joyce say that Melbourne City, we, as a City fan obviously, have progressed, not regressed in his press conference when we finished lower in fifth and were knocked out in the elimination final? When will the City Football Group show some ambition with a new manager?
Good question. Look, I'm not going to defend Warren Joyce. I think they've totally underachieved this season. I think they do need a new approach. I think it's bigger picture stuff, as I've said on the podcast before. It's about the ambition of the club, what they want it to be, what identity they want it to have. The only thing I will say in Warren's defence is that over the course of the two seasons, you know, over the two regular seasons, he and Marco Kurtz have been involved for exactly the same number of games. They've got exactly the same number of points.
Yep.
And yet Kurtz is lauded as a hero in the media. Joyce is the villain. Mm. Now, obviously, the expectations are different at Melbourne City because they are, theoretically at least, a big club with money to spend. The problem is they don't spend it. So does that make them a bigger club than Adelaide? I don't know. Interesting one.
Very.
Yeah. AK Chapman says, surely last night's game gives City Football Group all the evidence it needs to appoint Marco Kurz as a City coach next year.
Well, that's a fair question. But it depends what they want the club to be. Yeah. Is it just a development factory for young Australian footballers? In which case, they may think Warren Joyce is doing a perfectly good job.
But this is the thing for me. One very simple thing. Regardless of you want them to spend more money, better networking, better scouting, bring bigger names, all these things, the squad that he has at his disposal, the talent of those players on the field, should be playing better football, more entertaining football, and they're not.
Yep.
Can't disagree with that.
From Ivan Struggan, why don't people in the media recognise and celebrate all of Australia's national champions? The league didn't start 14 years ago. It started in 1977. Very good point, Ivan. He says a victory win a fifth championship will surpass the great South Melbourne. It's very pertinent. I think we are starting to do that.
Did I write that article last week?
I thought I saw some stuff on Twitter, especially the stats man, Andy Howe.
He's very good at putting it all together.
He's put it all together. Some of the stuff I've seen has been the two, sort of the NSL and Australian football and A-League, has been combined in all the records.
We're getting a lot better at it. There was a number of years there where we didn't combine them enough. But I think that it's not gone full circle, but it's more than three quarters now. So I think we've done that.
You know, the issue, I wrote that article last week about, you know, the historical tallying up of trophies, which still puts South Melbourne top with 12. Mm. Obviously, they're two very different eras, you know, professional, semi-professional. But you know, the correspondent is right that we need to recognise history an awful lot more, not just the national champions, but, you know, the players, the coaches, the history of the game, and not just the NSL, by the way, either. This game has been around nearly 150 years in Australia, and we don't remember any of it.
From Matthew Rasto, why does Adelaide only get a five-day break before their next game, while Victory gets nine, although they do have a Champions League game? You've answered your own question, Matthew. That's the reason why they've got a Champions League game. So that's why they've got that extra break, isn't it?
Exactly right. And Perth Glory finished top of the table, so they get all the advantage.
Exactly right. Yeah, and they deserve the advantage. Simple as that. So Adelaide will have to butter up quickly. That's on Friday night, boys. Thanks for your time in the podcast today.
Good to see you, Garby.
Comprehensive.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Good to see you both. Robbie, you're on to your next assignment. Your PA's waiting outside to take you in a courtesy car off to your next meeting.
His agent is counting
the
cash.
You won't have me back on, will you?
You'll be handed an itinerary for the next meeting.
And a big brown envelope.
Oh, yeah. How much do I get for this again?
$10.
That free water from the green room. Thanks, Rob. Thanks, Simon. Murray, Speedy and Harps back on Wednesday for the Ballcast. Listen to that one as we build up to a huge weekend of semi-final action in the A-League, and of course the final weekend in the Premier League. Can't wait for it. We'll be back next week to wrap that all up. Thanks for listening to the Fox Football Podcast.